Now it's recognized it?
Pardon me?
It's recognized it?
I hope so. I'll be able to know.
Great. So before you leave, I think we have to do that with. With my computer as well.
Yeah, sure. Okay, that should be good.
Great. So now, shall we test the sound briefly? Just go up, just make sure that we are. Can I close this one?
Mm-hmm.
Can I just get a thumbs up? Yeah. Great. Great. So I'll let try this. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Some people have new identities. Hey, Shield, I can see that. Like the NASA team, you know? They get in the cockpit and they get in there in the cockpit and strap you in.
You're in the racer seat now.
That's it, thanks. Okay. So let us begin this morning with the profound preliminaries that are turn our mind to the great perfection, unfolding the great perfection. So if we can ask the Umzi in Switzerland to lead us, that'd be great. Meditative moment. I don't know if Michael, maybe Michael can hear.
Michael, I think, just needs to turn his mic on. They should be able to hear us because we're not muted. Can you all, it's possible that that microphone's not working.
No, that's possible. Test it? Can anybody there out in Zoom land hear us? Raise your hand, yes?
Cynthia and Nathan have the thumbs up.
And Michael? Michael, can you hear us? Great. Michael, would you like to lead us this morning in the preliminaries?
Michael's mic is not turned on.
Michael, if you could turn your microphone on, that'd be great.
And it may not be working.
Okay. Not working. Okay. If you could lead us, Shmuel.
Da ji da jo dan san di chi ne ya ne ka we da re na me kun san di go an ru te san don cha da te ren jen lu di an chi da du ki da ra dong we nam nam chi excellent quality of mind
with leisure and endowments will be difficult to obtain repeatedly in the future. Right now, our call to consciousness today is to surpass the law of the Bhadra
to meaningfully benefit others. Also, it is not certain when the hateful enemy of this present precious body, Mara, death, will arrive. I and all beings are permanent, the time of death being uncertain. Since there is no opportunity for happiness wherever one is born in samsara, and since a happy existence was never seen, I will enter the path of Brahmana. In order for this body with leisure and wealth to possess meaning, I will abandon the three non-virtuous poisonous afflictions, develop diligence in virtuous actions, and protect the vows and commitments of the three yogas.
Going for refuge? Namo Tassa Namke Namke Senje Nam Duri Meso Lame Jajuba Jela Kundra Lama Lakta Chi Nodra Jusu Lidam Lakta Chi Arjo Kansa Kundra Lakta Chi Kani Sowa Sange Lakta Chi Shiva Jandra Dandra Lakta Chi Shoki Shinjo Genda Lakta Chi Trinle Nada Chokya Lakta Chi.
Namo. From now until the attainment of the last awakening, I and all other sentient beings equal to space go for refuge to the Guru, source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the Adamas, the source of Supreme City. We go for refuge to the Dakini, the sower of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the Sublime Dharma, peaceful, free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dhammapadas, masters of activity.
Namo.
From now until the attainment of the past awakening, I and all the sentient beings equal to space go for refuge to the Guru, source of all blessings. We go for refuge to the Adamas, the source of the supreme city. We go for refuge to the Dakini, speller of all obstacles. We go for refuge to the Buddha, the first among humans. We go for refuge to the Sublime Dharma, peaceful and free from attachment. We go for refuge to the Sangha, the supreme field of accumulation. We go for refuge to the Dhammapadas, masters of activity.
Generating bodhicitta.
Towards all, in order to attain the heart of awakening, in order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in the unsurpassed teachings, the path of the luminous superior Vajrasas.
May all sentient beings of samsara be free from suffering, be joyful and truly abide in supreme happiness. We generate the supreme mind, the partial towards all, in order to attain the heart of awakening. In order that we may fully benefit the beings of the six realms, we must attain the stage of Buddhahood in this very lifetime. Therefore, we will be very diligent in this unsurpassed teaching, the path of awareness and clear Vajra essence. Om Benza Sata Samaya Manipalaya Benza Sata Tano Padisha Dhrita Mevava Sita Kaya Mevava Sipa Kaya Mevava Anurakta Mevava Sava Siddhi Vibraya Sava Karma Sutra Mehe Chita Shriyam Kuruvam
short mandala offer.
Sashi, sashi, pocho, sho, sheng, me, to, tram, pri, rabun, shi, ne, de, champa, de, sanje, sheng, la, me, de, po, va, yi, tro, ku, na, za,
moistened with scented waters, arranged with flowers, and adorned with Subaru and the four continents, as well as the sun and the moon. By offering the visualized Buddha field, may all migrating beings take birth in the pure Buddha field. Om Guru Deva Dakini, Radha Mandala Praticha Swaha. The Guru Yoga Accumulation Recitation. Om. Ah. Om. Rang Re Ka Da Sing Gong Su Rang Dang Gong Re Po Trang Da Rang Sa Sa We La 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 Da Yi Du We So Ba Da Ja Lu Ba Jin Ji
reveal that one's own original and pure awareness in the palace of unceasing inner radiance is one's own vibrant energy, the root guru, to whom we supplicate with a devoted mind, bless us to accomplish the rainbow body. Om, ah, hum. In the Buddha field of one's own originally pure awareness, in the palace of unceasing inner radiance, is one's own vibrant energy, the root guru, to whom we supplicate with a devoted mind, bless us to accomplish the rainbow body.
So let us continue with the Bodhicitta Vivarana. But we'll first start with some questions. If you have any questions about what has been covered to date, now that you've had a chance to read the prologue of the text that we're mostly using, doesn't mean that the other texts are wrong. Sometimes, especially later on, we'll go back and forth between the two because some translations are much clearer than others. Right away. But let's just see if you have any questions, that something you don't understand or something that is puzzling you or something like that. Yes?
I'm having trouble understanding the third paragraph because I don't know what the secret mantra is, and I also don't understand the conventional aspect in form of an aspiration.
Ah, very good. Well, because it's secret, nobody does. So we can't talk about it. Jeff, you'll have to whisper it. Joking aside, secret mantrayana, there's a couple meanings to that. Secret mantra. Mantra means protection. It's not just sound that one utters, but it actually protects one against conventional speech, run-on speech, unethical speech, unvirtuous speech, conceptual contrivances that don't go anywhere, and so on and so forth. Starting with unwholesome speech, then wholesome speech, and then purifying to beatific speech, and eventually purifying to awakened speech of the Nirmanakaya and Sambhogakaya, the form bodies of Buddhas. The other meaning besides mantra is actually awareness. Sound, when it's purified, is actually the sound of awareness. Awareness actually begins to emanate sound, pure awareness. And we can hear that. So when we say the mantra of Vajrasattva, Om Vajrasattva Samayaha Manupalaya, we're actually drinking in sound, a pure sound of the 100 meditational deities. But we're also vibrating loose the stuck channels, the winds and the drops of our subtle body, like our subtle nervous system. So when we say that, we're actually purifying the impure, let's not use the word impure, the twisted, bound, energetic nervous system, if you wish, an endocrine system that's been twisted and turned and bound by conditioning, genetic, epigenetic, social, parental, it doesn't matter, history. And we're unbinding it through pure sound and merged with awareness. So in that sense, when we use mantra, we're actually protecting ourselves from going into unwholesome and partial states, even though they may be good. The other meaning behind one of the meaning is when we talk about secret, we also mean inner that's not normally available or in the awareness radar of most people, not trained in it. Just as if someone's a professional musician, many people wouldn't get what the professional musician's experiencing because they've been at it for 10 or 20 years. We normally don't experience the same way a conductor does conducting a symphony because we simply don't have that training. We're missing 90% of what they're experiencing. Make sense? So in that sense, the word secret actually means hidden. Hidden. Because it's extremely subtle, but extremely profound. Yeah? Secret also means that we practice by ourselves and we don't display to the public. In other words, the practices that we do, we mostly do in the quiet of our cabin, the quiet of our room, the quiet of our cave, and we're not going out there blasting people with mantras and all kinds of ritual objects and look at me, I'm a Buddhist practitioner, look at me, I'm a secret mantra practitioner. And we basically do it in private because not only does it disturb others, but they can't necessarily relate to it. Yeah? So there's many levels of the meaning of secret. Secret also refers to the secret level of refuge. The secret level of refuge is the three Buddha bodies, the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. So there's a whole bunch of meanings behind secret. So the term secret mantrayana is exact the same as the word vajrayana, as exact the same as secret tantrayana or the vehicle of tantrayana. So that's a little bit of an introduction. When it says vajrayana or secret mantrayana, it can be translated as vajrayana. It means the vehicle of the third turning of the Buddha's teaching, which means the view is pervasive Buddha nature. Not just freedom of you, not just freedom of your mind, but the actual freedom that comes from the three Buddha bodies, not just the Dharmakaya, not just the indestructible, unspeakable, non-conceptual nature, but the pervasive luminosity of great love, and how that communicates freedom and dharma. So that's just a very brief introduction. The practices of secret mantra are highly skillful practices to cut through stuck view. And the stuck views, we're going to go through all the stuck views in this text. Believe me, not all of them, but we're going to go through a whole bunch of stuck views through the history of India, the history of Buddhism, the history of us. Because actually, as I said yesterday, you may not really, really understand it now or even feel it or go, I don't believe this. You might even not go, I don't believe this, but somewhere deep inside you go, I don't believe this. Is the only thing in the way to all of this is stuck concepts. That's it. That's it. But the concepts are not just mental things. They're actually locked in the physiology. So they take time to soften and let go, like a massage. Yeah? If someone touches you and starts, you know, you might go, and massage is actually impossible. But if you do what we do in Feldenkrais, is we start from the external and go to the core and go very gently, the core relaxes and the conceptual holding to be tight gets loosened. So we do the same thing in Vajrayana, is we have very skillful means that are very close to the experience of a high-level bodhisattva or a Buddha, and we use skillful means, like a massage, to get at the core concept, which is the ignorance about the nature of experience. Okay, there's a summary. A little bit about secret Vajrayana. If you teach secret mantrayana teachings, the third teachings of the Buddha's Dharma, for most people you'll scare that. Pardon me, you'll scare the hell out of them. It'll be so foreign. Not because it's weird to some people, but it's weird to a Western mind and even weird to many Eastern Buddhist minds. There have been Buddhist teachers who've been driven out of their monasteries for teaching Dzogchen and Mahamudra. It's hard to handle. There's been teachers, many teachers have been killed and poisoned and beaten up because the experience is uncomfortable to a conventional mind. Okay? So we're careful. when it comes to this word conventional aspect, the conventional aspect here of aspiration is loving kindness. May all beings be happy. That makes sense? We wish all beings to be happy. That's conventional. Can all beings be happy? No, actually, they can't. As long as a being believes in self and believes in attachment to concepts and outer objects, they can't actually be happy. They can be temporarily happy in a conventional way, but they won't be gut happy. And it won't last more than anywhere from a second, half an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours a day before they're seeking out another object to make them happy. So there is conventional aspiration, which is really good, such as may all beings be imbued with loving kindness, may all beings eat well, may all beings drink clean water, may all beings have relatively good health. Those are really important. We have a society here that believes in that, and that's just great. Canadian society is truly amazing that way, is that we uphold those principles as naturally almost constitutional principles. That's really something else, isn't it? But they don't actually lead to a profound happiness based on the nature of experience. They are based on holding and clinging onto an object or an idea that actually dissolves as soon as it starts. Make sense? Yeah. So we need conventional things to help people have the strength to grow into the non-conventional. That's skillful. That's called compassion. So loving kindness, which is right there as a question, right there. Don't know who asked it. Who asked that question? That's okay. Don't mind. Loving kindness is the wish for beings to have excellent support, to be comfortable, eat well, have good access to health, be comfortable, be happy. Does that make sense? That's being kind. When you feel good and kind, you feel like you can mix. You're not defensive. That means you feel like you're part of other beings, you feel like you're taken care of, you feel like you're loved. It's not affection, it's actually a feeling of unity. It's a feeling of, I can be with these beings. It's a non-defensive position. It's a non-angry position. Okay. When we come to compassion, compassion is different. It's the same but different. Compassion is called great love in the teaching because compassion is there to remove the causes of the suffering, not support more suffering. So, you may send somebody to a hospital to get better, but as one doctor said to me, when we bring people here, sometimes we make them better, but we also make them worse. In other words, the conventional help doesn't take away the root of the problem. Sometimes in a hospital, yes, we take away the fact that there's a broken bone or there's a malfunctioning heart, put a new heart in, and actually it's a pretty good solution. But it doesn't get at the core issue of suffering, which is greed, hatred, delusion, of which delusion is the main one. Not understanding this experience of self and other is actually the core of all mental suffering. So no matter how you fix things up, there's going to still be suffering. Whether you get a new heart, you get a new brain, there's people working on brain transplants right now, coming to a place near you, brain transplants, heart transplant, kidney, no matter what you transplant, you can still have a miserable SOB. You know? I've seen people in hospitals that are absolutely miserable, getting the best care in the world. And they are mad, they're fierce, they hate their doctors, they hate the hospital and everything around. They don't realize everybody's trying to actually help them. So, conventional is absolutely essential, but it doesn't liberate. Therefore, we have two types of dharma. We have a dharma that supports the unfolding of beings, and we have dharma that removes the the roots and the causes of suffering of beings for liberation and real freedom. Okay. That's really what it is. So those are the two aspirations. So you see in the prayer of bodhicitta, we have two aspirations. We have a conventional aspiration, which is the compassion, the relative compassion, relative love for all beings, and the wish for them to be relatively free. And then we have Osol Dorje Ningpo at the end, which is the luminous radiance of Dzogchen, the great perfection of Buddha nature. May all beings attain Buddha nature as being the ultimate source of refuge and the ultimate source of liberation. So that's the unconventional. Good. Any other questions? So it says here, could you speak to how loving kindness practice and Chenrezig practice are similar, different, and related? Let me come to that bit by bit. The short of it is that Chenrezig is loving kindness, but Chenrezig embodies more the compassion aspect of great wisdom with great love to remove the roots and the seeds of suffering states. Okay. Good. Any other questions? It's a good one. All clear? Great. Yeah? Good. So let's start with number two here. Number two on page one. This is the translation that was given out yesterday. I'll read it first. The Buddhas maintain the awakening mind, bodhicitta, to be not obscured by such conceptions as consciousness of self, aggregates, and so on. It is always characterized by emptiness. So let's go through that. The Buddhas, if you see the word Buddha in Sanskrit literally means fully awake. It means awake. That's its main meaning. In Tibetan, the word Buddha, Sangye, really means purification, fully purified. So a being of full realization, a being fully purified, maintain the awakening mind, the bodhicitta. And the word maintain is a little bit obscuring there. I wouldn't use the word maintain. The Buddhas don't maintain. Maybe the word is contend or declare, because they're residing in a place where the bodhicitta, the ultimate bodhicitta and conventional bodhicitta, are perfected or complete. So when we use the word maintain, it's not like maintenance, it's more like declare the awakening mind to not be obscured, not be muddied, not be cloudy by such conceptions, such views, such ideas as consciousness of self. That it's the mixing around the vague ideas of consciousness and self as real, as entities and aggregates, the five aggregates, as real entities, and so on. So those are mentioned at the beginning. That is the aggregates, the five aggregates of form or body, of feeling, of perception, of volitional states, and consciousness, dualistic consciousness, and so on. All these things are considered to be real by the Shratantikas, the Vibhashikas, and the Theravadins. He's coming out and saying, from the point of view of full realization, all these things that are considered to be real, a real self, a non-real self, the aggregates, the elements, and so on, are always characterized. We can also translate characterized as marked or stamped by emptiness. So he's basically coming right out and declaring that as he does in all of Nagarjuna's writings and teachings, which is the pillar of Mahayana, all things, anything that is a thing, even a concept, is empty of any intrinsic nature. Let me give you an example, because some people really keep, and it's worth repeating many times until you really, really understand it, is this book here, called a book, is a concept. Less, more accurately, the book should be described as a collection of papers. Yes? Different papers with ink. We call a thing that's put together with papers, with ink and words, we call a book. So you see, the book is a stand-in for something much bigger and much more vast in concept. When we take a microscope, we see that the actual pages are made of cellulose fibers. We can actually see the individual fibers. So we're not looking at a book anymore. I hope everybody's getting this. We're not looking at a book, we're looking at fibers. We call those things fibers. So in a page, there may be 30, 40,000 fibers. If we go into the fibers with a microscope, we're no longer in book experience, we're in fiber experience. Make sense? When we look at the ink, we see that the ink isn't black, we see that the ink is purple. There's no, except for pure carbon inks, there's no black inks. I've taken many of them apart in the laboratory, they're all purple. And they're all made of many colors to get black. This is not black. This is deep blue purple. We're fooled to believing it's black. If we take a good look at this, we'll see it's actually blue or purple. So once we do that, we're no longer in the ink. We're in the chemistry. We're in the soup of it. Making sense? So when you get used to this, everything is basically really a label of something much more vast. And every time we shift our view, we're into a new world. We're into a new idea, a new concept. And in fact, all the names and things are placeholders. Does that make sense? They're just placeholders to communicate. But most beings take the placeholders to be real entities, and they cling to the placeholder as if it's a real thing. And the suffering comes because of attachment and clinging to a placeholder. Does this make sense? It's one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to actually experience it to the point where you're very loose about it. You're actually very easeful about using placeholders, but they actually don't cling, or you don't cling or glom onto them. Does that make sense? They don't cause suffering. That's called the two-in-one truth. So the word emptiness here means empty of any real defining characteristic. Even atoms. Atoms have no defining characteristics. When we look at an atom, what is an atom? It's a field of, conventionally, of electrons, neutrons, and protons. Yes? But actually, it's described as an energy field, not with real entities. Has anybody here seen an atom? Anybody gone to a lab where there's an electron microscope and you can put atoms up on the screen? Image atoms? Anybody ever done that? It's kind of fun. Laurel, you've done that. Are those atoms, or are those conceptual images on a screen? So one's not looking at atoms, one's looking at dots on a screen. But we're fooled into believing, even scientists, because I've seen that with my own eyes, where scientists say, no, those are atoms. They're not atoms, they're little light balls of pixels on a screen. And if we go further, we can't find atoms. What we find is we find energy fields, we find quarks, and we find all kinds of subatomic particles, which turn out to be energy fields of undefinable location and position and energy. Okay? So depending on how you view the world and your concepts, you're stuck in a certain placement, a certain fixity. What's the biggest fixity that we are centered in all day long? The biggest fixity. An illusory self that must be protected, maintained, supported, bolstered, defended at all costs. We're not even talking about atoms here. We're not talking about paper. We're not talking about inks. We're talking about an ego, which has nobody can even decide what an ego is. I just read the beginning of a PhD thesis on emotion and Buddhism and Western psychotherapy. And it just starts off, the PhD, I can't find a definition for emotion. Nobody's ever been able to pin it down, but they use it all the time. And every school of psychotherapy and every school of neurobiology and everybody else in psychology uses emotion a different way. And yet they all think it is a thing, but they can't pin it down to anything. See? But yet we use it, and we think we feel like it's something, but... So this is what Nagarjuna is getting at. It's actually extremely important. So the word characterized is probably better translated as stamped or marked. That is, every single thing or concept, of which things are concepts, has the quality of being empty of any real identifiable true entity-ness. So is that okay? Understood? Okay. Number three. If you have a chance to look at this book that I've put together called Blazing Awakeness, which is a summary of the book of the Southeast Asian Vipassana traditions, just like a condensation of all of them into one short, pithy little book, you will see that it starts off by defining the characteristics of what's real in the Vipassana tradition, which comes from the Abhidhamma tradition, that what is real, they're called paramatta, is citta, states of conscience, chaitasika, factors of conscience, rupa, which is form and matter, and nibbana. Of which those form 202 words or categories, which are considered to be ultimately real. Nagarjuna, as an extraordinary yogi, and as a proponent of the third turning of the Buddha's teaching, like the Heart Sutra, says, no, in fact, he's not disagreeing with the Buddha, he's actually looking at the Buddha's teaching very closely, and what the Buddha said, they're actually not real, they're actually stamped with the nature of emptiness, which is real. It might not sound important, but it's going to get even more important for all the meditations and contemplations. Number three, it is with a mind moistened, that is, our mind moistened, that's a beautiful word, softened, moistened, imbued, dripping by compassion, relative and ultimate, conventional and ultimate compassion, that you must cultivate awakening mind, bodhicitta, with effort. The Buddhas who embody great compassion constantly develop this awakening mind. So this is an extraordinary statement. The first line is saying we must imbue, drink in compassion into our conventional mind. And he's saying, he's being very declarative, he's being very clear. And I would listen to Nagarjuna as one of the greatest saints ever in the history of Dharma. You must cultivate or generate bodhicitta with effort. And I've known many people have asked me through the years, over and over again, well, if we awaken and we're free, wouldn't compassion be absolutely natural? Why do I need to practice compassion if I free my mind? It makes sense, doesn't it? It makes perfect sense. In other words, the more loving kindness I have, the more I feel free, the more light and bubbly and calm and tranquil, of course I'll have compassion for all beings. Not so. Turns out, not so. Go teach meditation. It's not the case. Go practice. So the history of Dharma is very clear on that point. Unless you make a lot of effort to keep generating and cultivating relative and ultimate compassion, you can easily slip into states that you'll see written about, which is your freedom of your mind, your luminosity, your awakening. And these are real experiences where you don't realize that you're not actually realizing the mind of all beings and the suffering of all beings. So actually, it turns out, I'm going to make a bold statement to you, and you can please be free to disagree, but I want you to try it out. And this is completely un-Western and completely un-Western spiritual, but it's the heart of Dharma. And it's not what you want to do, believe me. How's that for setting up a straw woman? The more that you study and the more that you contemplate suffering of all beings, the greater will be your compassion. See? It's obvious. That ring was suspicious. We want happiness. In fact, the Buddha's first teaching started with what is unhappiness and what is the cause of unhappiness? We're going for a causal happiness, which is don't worry about how it's caused. We don't care, right? Let's just be happy. Let's do things that make us happy. But unless you know the cause, the root cause, you'll be shuffling pieces on a chessboard for the rest of your life trying to get it right. Don't believe me. Go try it out. Okay. So, therefore, the more we understand how suffering occurs conventionally and ultimately, the greater will be our depth of compassion for beings because we'll really understand what they're going through and be able to help them with removing the deepest causes of their suffering. So with effort, we have to make supreme effort to get over the selfishness which says, let me do my thing and let me just feel tranquil and happy and clear and not thought and no thoughts because I'll feel good and from that place I can help people. But actually, by engaging with people, by engaging with a heart of compassion, we awaken to a much greater place. We end up with emptiness compassion, not just emptiness. The Buddhas, the awakened beings who embody great compassion. This is the next two lines. The awakened beings who embody great compassion or great love constantly develop or cultivate or unfold this awakening mind. Beautiful, this thought of enlightenment. Now you'll say, why do Buddhas have to do that? Well, the question really then is it Buddhas or is it Bodhisattvas? So if you look at other translations, it says constantly develop this awakening mind. This bodhicitta is constantly developed by the compassionate Buddhas. So depending on how you interpret that, and that's a hard one to translate, it might be that Christian Lintner's translation is probably right on. The Buddhas are developing bodhicitta for the benefit of others, because a fully awakened being has developed bodhicitta. So that's always been a little mysterious line to me. I would probably go with the translation of bodhicitta is constantly developed for the benefit of beings by the compassionate Buddha. It's a tough one. Sanskrit is funny that way. You can translate this way, that way, and many times we have to, instead of going literal translations, we have to see what the oral tradition is. What's the lineage transmission? If we don't have the lineage transmission, we are going to the dictionary and we're translating in a way that may not actually be in the spirit, because these are pithy verses. They're not detailed expositions. So the commentaries, one has to go then to the commentaries and see what the oral tradition is. Okay? You could say, why would a fully awakened being like the Buddha? It's said that the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, kept meditating all his life. Why would he meditate all his life when he's fully awakened? What for? For the benefit of other beings. So as Namjoon Rinpoche said, if you are so fortunate to become an arahat or to attain to arahat, your emotional freedom in this lifetime, then you've got a lot of work ahead of you. What's the work? Is the freedom to explore and the freedom to unfold other beings. You see? So to me, this makes perfect sense. The Buddhas are constantly unfolding compassion for the benefit of the, and that is what a Sambhogakaya or Nirmanakaya Buddha or Tulku or a high-level Bodhisattva does, is they're constantly generating compassion, enlightened compassion, for the benefit of other beings, to stir up the bodhicitta in other beings. Does a bodhisattva have to use a rosary in public? No. Why would they use a rosary in public? For the benefit of other beings. If you've done a billion mantras, if you've done 100 million mantras, why do you need to be, you know, out there in public with a rosary or a rosary on your wrist? Why? The rosary is already circulating all the time. It never stops. Right? That's the rosary. So why would you do it? For the benefit of other beings. Why would the Dharmapa keep putting a black hat on in a ceremony like this when he's always wearing a black hat of chen raising? Why does he need to have a ceremony? Out of great compassion. At least that was my experience. Okay. So what a great bodhisattva, a great Buddha does is they're constantly developing this awakening mind in other beings through great compassion. Number four, the self postulated by the extremists. Now, if this was a university course, number four would be at least a week or a month if this was a university course. We'd stop here and go, okay, folks, we're deep into the history of Indian philosophy to understand this one verse. We're not going to do that. We're not even going to spend a whole class on it. We're going to spend a bit of time to understand why this is important to Nagarjuna, why it's important to Buddhists. These extremists, which basically go between nihilists and eternalists, are called the Tirthikas. That's the name for all these different schools, these five major schools in Indian, the history of Indian philosophy, that would debate with Buddhists for hundreds of years. And we can go into every single school, and they have. There are people that have really studied this deeply. And I think the best thing to do is just to give you some examples. Of why this is important. And the reason why this is important is because, I'm going to give you an exercise, is because we all do this, but we don't know we're doing it. We're all basically vacillating most of the time between eternalism and nihilism. So I'm going to come back to the three clingings the Buddha taught. Remember these, and this is a Vipassana meditation. This is Anupassana meditation, which is classic, especially in Southeast Asia, and the Buddha taught this, is the clinging to sense objects, sensory experience, kamma bhava, this clinging, kamatana, clinging to any kind of sensory impulse and holding on to it. We do that most of the day. Our eyes, our ears, our cognitive sense, our touch, like this, fractions of a second, like that. Most people don't know that. If you ever ask them, say, I'm not doing that, I'm being very attentive. No, the conscious is switching in fractions of a second between sensory objects, all right? The other kind of clinging that we do, which I mentioned yesterday, but boy, I could talk about this every single day. I won't, but I don't know. Is clinging to being. Who am I going to be? What am I going to be? When am I going to be? Why am I? Where am I going? What am I going to be when I grow up? When I'm 70 years old, who am I going to be when I'm 80? When I'm 25, who am I going to be when I'm 30? And so on and so on. What job, what career, who will I be with? I'm going to become a great meditator. I'm going to become a great doctor. I'm going to become a great musician. I'm going to become a great administrator. I'm going to be a great mom, great dad. And then there's days when you go, gosh, I just wish I'd be nothing. I'd sure like to just hole up and have my mind silent. No anxiety, no worries, nothing at all. Just get rid of it all. Yeah? The extreme being suicide. You ever had those? Everybody goes through that. If you were to put yourself in a room, not like this, this is a very busy room, with white walls, or something like that, a cabin, maybe the Beaver Dam cabin or Hermitage, something like that, and you sit there all day long, and you don't actually practice meditation, you just observe with absolute clarity what's really going on overall, you'll see that you're going to be bouncing, as the Buddha said, because he was a genius, you will bounce around between kamatanha, clinging to sensory objects, clinging to being, which is things about, why am I sitting here? Like, what am I doing here? What should I be doing? So bhavatanha, clinging to being, and then states of, God, I just wish it would all go away. Would I just stop everything and just have a blank, nice, clear, blank mind, yeah, with no thoughts, and just sit here like, we bhavatanha, you see, cling to no being. So we're actually a bunch of dirtikas. So we say, those dirtikas back in ancient India who held all those extreme positions of God and self and all that. No, we do. So don't think it's them. We're doing the same thing. We have, everything's just matter. So I'm going to give you an exercise, which is different than a blank mind. Is I would like you to start writing down in a notebook all your concepts. Get them out. Don't hold them in. Get them out. Just start listing the major concepts that you hold of your life. One-liners. I do have a self. It's real. Everything is matter. Emotions truly exist. Emotions don't truly exist. Whatever it is. I must eat 3 meals a day. And it must be a balanced meal. And it must be a meal of balance between a protein, carbohydrates, and starches, and so on. So just get it all out on the table and look at it. What do you believe to be real? I must be a Buddhist. Buddhism's good. Anyways, write them all out. I don't want to see them. Believe me, I don't want to see them. But it's really important to get them out on paper and see what's actually driving your being in terms of karma. What's the major volitional, hidden, conceptual fields? We think that when we meditate and we have a silent, clear mind, that we're free of concepts. Not at all. We have these big sharks and these big whales moving the energy fields around, and these are the deep conceptual fields that we're holding that we can't even see. That's why we do the preliminary liberating instructions. They're working away at our deepest conceptual levers. You just try doing 100,000 mandala offerings. Just try it. 100,000 vajrasattvas. 100,000 refuges and prostrations and bodhicitta. Just see how your all your concepts are going to be challenged, yeah, by such a giant concept as full awakening for all sentient beings. So we could go through all of these. I'm just going to go through a few just to give you an idea of the extremists. So here's one. The Samkhyas believe that beings circle in samsara due to mistakenly, actually it's a really complex one, the nature of prakriti. That's a really complex one, but it basically holds again to a self as being real. The Jains, the naked ones, assert that all objects of knowledge are included in 9 categories: life, contamination, restraint, wearing down, bond, karma, sin, merit, and liberation. For them, liberation is attained through asceticism, through going naked and not speaking, and so on. And basically attaining a godlike state at the top of the world. There's others that are completely materialistic, that only the 4 elements exist. They don't believe in reincarnation or rebirth, and they seek happiness in this life. That is, don't be concerned about anything but being happy in this life. So we have that too, don't we? So this isn't ancient India. This is actually pretty modern, current stuff today. They also for instance, consciousness is considered to be a product of matter, just like the intoxicating power of alcohol is the product of fermentation of grains. So these ones negate any causality of previous lifetimes. And future lifetimes are denied. When the body perishes, the mind also perishes. Anyways, to go through these 5 schools would take a long time, and it's a huge body. There's like 360 different views that are conceptually contrived views. But Mipham Rinpoche, the great 19th century saint of India, summarized these extreme positions. And the reason I'm going over this is not because it's a scholastic lesson in ancient India. It's because we hold all these too. It's not new. It's not something old. It's something just ancient. It's something that we hold as well. He says, Mipham Lama said, although the Tirthakas have many different beliefs, when condensing the root of all of them, there are only 2. Proponents of eternalism and proponents of nihilism. The proponents of eternalism believe that either the self, time, or the Almighty God is the creator of the entire world. Self creates the world, time creates the world, the Time Lord, the great Time Lord, or a God, a being God, creates the world. They hold that this creator is permanent, that God as a being is a permanent entity. The proponents of nihilism claim that the present world originated by itself without causes. It just suddenly came up. Just happened. Such as past karma, the consciousness occurred suddenly from the 4 elements, that out of out of matter, consciousness suddenly appeared. You just mix matter the right way, kind of like modern view, yeah, brain. Just get a brain big enough, complex enough, and all of a sudden you have a self like we have just pop out. So we have that today too. That self is discontinued at the time of death, and it's pointless to exert one on the path of liberation in order to achieve liberation. All of these, Amitpham Lama says, however, all of these are proponents of the existence of a self, of a real self. Then he says, according to another text, because of all these worldly paths are posited from the point of view of the ordinary mind, which sees only partiality and is concomitant with beginningless, co-emergent ignorance, in the last analysis, they all come down to one thing, the assertion of a truly existent entity. That's the important point. So what I'd like you to do, take some time today or tomorrow or the next day, maybe 3 or 4 days, and write down the concepts and look at them from the point of view of fixed concreteness of a self or no self, and see what you're bringing into your life. In other words, your position. Do you know what I mean by that? Your mudra, your position. What position are you taking when you talk to people? What position are you taking when you go to the kitchen? What position are you taking when you sit down and eat a meal? When you sit and meditate and you go like this, and I'm going, I'm going to practice being Chenrezig, I'm going to practice hollow body and loving kindness. What's the position, the background position, the briefing paper? You know, in government, when the prime minister gets up or a minister gets up to talk, he's got a position paper in front of him, which is the position paper of the government or the department, and he's speaking from that position paper. We don't know that, but he's got a briefing paper that says the position of the department is such and such. You're not allowed to deviate from that. It's not your personal... The minister of transportation doesn't speak personally here. He speaks from the position of his department. What department are we speaking from? Canadian Constitutional Department? A little bit different than the American? Is it the American Constitutional Department? Is it the Bolivian Constitutional Department? Is it a European view? You think, oh, I'm not subject to that. Absolutely, we are subject to that. It sits in the background. So when we sit like this, we think it's gone, no matter how tranquil we are. But give it a push or a poke, it'll rear. It'll just grow. So in that sense, those positions are real entities to us, that when you poke someone the wrong way, they blow at you. Have you ever experienced that? If you were to go up to a Canadian, nice Canadian, and say, you NDP, or you Liberal, or you Conservative, you might get punched out, especially up here, or in Toronto, you might just get punched out on the street, or you, in the United States, you said, yeah, you Democrat. You might even get shot. Canadians, we have a lot of rifles. We have a lot of guns. Don't shoot each other. We're really good at passive aggressiveness. Yeah. Really, really good at passive aggressiveness. We pull out passive aggressiveness first. So that's only partly true. So the point I want to make, I hope it gets across, is that these concepts that feel like they're flimsy are actually not truly solid, but actually really solid in our being. And as soon as we get poked, they erupt, no matter how calm and clear we are. Okay? Good. It's funny, when you look at me, it sometimes look like, with your mask on, look like a bunch of bandits. Yeah. You get it? When you thoroughly, number 4, when you thoroughly analyze it with reasoning. Now, this is not just clever reasoning. This is profound contemplation of epistemology, a profound contemplation of analyzing one's views and analyzing what's before us. Just with simple, straightforward reasoning. Within all the aggregates of body and mind, all the things that are considered real, nowhere can you find a locus for this self, this conceptual being. And when it says locus, it's a fancy word for saying location, spot, seat, or substantial reality. Yeah? This forms the core practice of all the insight traditions of all Buddhism. You're looking at the practice. Is it? In other words, if you want to know where all the insight, wisdom, meditation come from, Vipassana, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, this is number four, and that will be expanded upon. Can you find a self even though you feel emotionally like there's a self? Just because you feel it is doesn't mean it is, and this is very scientific. Just because you observe something doesn't mean that actually, in fact, it's the case. Just because two things look similar doesn't mean at all that they're related. So, for instance, if we have Laurel here, and we take another woman or a man, and we get a hairdresser in to copy Laurel's hair, we fit the person out with the similar glasses, we put the same clothing on, we may say, oh, look, they're likely sisters. That's all it would take. We do this all the time. So by association of features, we make jumps of conceptual leaps to things that are false. All the time. I want to see if you can spot those. They're happening all the time. We make judgments, we make stories, we make fabrication constructions by association, but we don't test it. Only later do we find, if we're willing to admit clearly, it was wrong. Anybody ever have that experience? That we made up a story and it was completely wrong? I know people who make up stories all the time, but they don't know they're wrong. I've had people tell me, I'm always right. Or, my intuition is perfect. Well, what happened yesterday? I was right on. No, it wasn't. How often do we construct a reality out of associations that are untested? Causes that aren't causes, associations that aren't associations. It's bright in here, isn't it? That's because of the sun. Sounds right, doesn't it? Would you say the sun rises? How many people would say the sun rises? Let's show hands. Sun rises, right? Everybody sees that. Sun doesn't rise. The earth turns. So would you say that because we have an experience of self, we've given a word for it, which we spend a lot of time self-referencing, is that right? Anybody say they don't self-reference? Any fully awakened beings in the room? Maybe a fully awakened being does reference. They just self-reference, but they just do it in such a way it's utterly compassionate for the welfare of all sentient beings. Could a phenomena, an experience, be given a name, but the name has nothing to do with the experience? Could the experience of self be so solid due to conditioning, but it's an epiphenomena? In other words, it's generated out of other things, but it feels like it's real. This is actually now mainstream neurocognitive science. most publications will say the self is a generated illusion of the brain. And so is, it used to be that we used to think in neurophysiology 20 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, quite mainstream, that all of perception and cognitive process is modular. It's found in different parts of the brain. It's now known that it's completely distributed all over the brain. The brain is very, very plastic. And you'll see that with stroke patients especially. So looking for the seat of the self was a major pastime of neurobiologists, neurocognitive scientists. They've kind of given that up. Looking for the seat, that like those cluster of cells that's like the self. You can just put a pinprick in about here, you know, and you'll lose yourself. Just put a pinprick here because you can't recognize yourself. And yet you feel like you have a self, but you can't recognize yourself in the mirror. Just takes a little tiny pinprick. Nowhere can you find a locus or location. So there you go. One of the classic meditations in the Southeast Asian tradition, in the Mahamudra Dzogchen tradition, is a teacher will tell you, I want you to determine where your self is located. Are you going to do that? You can take 3 or 4 days or a week to go, I'm going to trace down and track down the location of where I feel myself. So it used to be when we had innocent Dharma students, we don't have innocent Dharma students anymore, but it used to be a long time ago where we'd have innocent Dharma students who would practice all kinds of meditations. And then they hear teachings about non-self or non-real self. And they'd say to the teacher, I don't get it. I really don't get it. And because they're really good students, this is quite traditional in the Mahamudra and Dzogchen traditions, they'd send the student away for a month or 3 months, because they're very innocent students. And the teacher would say, I want you to find yourself. I want you to find consciousness. I want you to tell me where it's located. Go take a long time until you pin it down. You come back and tell me exactly where it is. And normally what would happen is a person would come back either many times and say, I found it here, and the teacher would analyze it for them, and they go, oh, okay, so it's not there. Oh, I found it here, but what are you finding? Oh, I found a sensation. Well, is the sensation itself? No. I found it in my foot. No. I found it in a tree. Well, how did you find yourself in a tree? They do this. But many, many beings who go away, who really well practice the meditation, would come back after a month or 3 months, the teacher, and say, I've completely failed. I've miserably failed, teacher. I'm really sorry. I'm really hopeless. Why? I can't find a self anywhere. I've looked. It appears, but I can't find the location. I can't find its place. I can't catch it. I can't see it. And, of course, the usual response by teachers, congratulations, you're on the right track. We can begin. That's because of the innocent student. Today, it's very complicated. Very complicated. We have non-innocent students. Number 5. Aggregates exist, but are not permanent. So this would be a Theravadin position. This would be a classic Theravadin insight position. The aggregates, the 5 skandhas, form, for those that are new, form, feeling, perception, volitional states, states of mind, and a consciousness, that is subject-object consciousness, exist, but they're not permanent. In other words, the way to experience them, to gain freedom, is to see that they come and go. Anybody practice that? Anybody practice it? Yeah? And you're told by a teacher to just see it come and go. And there's many books written on this, that if you just watch things come and go, you'll experience Nietzsche, and therefore you'll be free of it. Right? Whole books written on that. Whole teachings written on it. So they exist, they truly exist. States exist, emotions exist, elements exist, body exists, it's all real, but they just come and go. They keep changing, and because they keep changing, you can't cling to them. Okay? And they do not have, but then he says, they do not have the nature of selfhood, of an entity. A permanent and an impermanent cannot exist as support and the supporter. Another way of saying this is you can't get away with these two things. It's not going to work. Causality doesn't work by it's either permanent and impermanent or impermanent and permanent. So basically saying it can't exist. It's either supported or it's either the support or the supported. But these things, these aggregates, don't exist as supports, and they don't exist as supported. You have to analyze. You have to really look at these very, very clearly. So he's basically demolishing, logically and experientially, that the aggregates truly exist but are not permanent. So the way to make them empty is you make them transitory. Let me know if everybody follows this. This is like fundamental in Dharma. The way you make things go away is make them impermanent. Therefore, I'm okay. The way I don't cling to a building is I say to myself, it's impermanent, and I see it's impermanent. Therefore, I can't cling to it. Correct? But what you're saying is the building's actually permanent. You can't buy it both ways. You're still saying that the entity that you're observing is permanent, but it's permanent thing, but it keeps changing. Is everybody following that? Maybe not. Because it changes, I can't cling to it. But you're still holding on to it as a real thing. The tree changes, but I can't cling to the tree. But you're still believing the tree is a real thing. Here's another one. Let's go even closer. I can't cling to my emotions because they're ever-changing. But what you're saying is that the emotions are real, but I just can't hold on to them. I can't hold on to them. Does that make sense? This is an insight position. It's pretty darn good. It's just not real. He's saying it's unreal. You gotta give it up. If you want to go further for Buddhahood, you have to give it up. It can't exist. Yeah. Don't have a heart attack.
So would it be more accurate, let's say I see a building, would it be more accurate to just try and observe myself labeling it, remove the label, and just kind of say, like, this is whatever this is, I don't know, this is a sight, and it changes and goes away in my experience.
You're still kind of position of their sight is real, and I'm real. So what you'll see as we go through this is we're looking for the indefinable. So when we look at sight very closely, we see that the sight actually is held by concepts. The idea of sight is held by concepts. The idea of a self perceiving the sight is held by concepts. When we look very closely, just like looking at a cloud, we see that the cloud really isn't there. Okay? So it's empty of any solidity. That's the important part. It's actually empty of any clinging. I'll get there. So we have to be careful. We have to really hear the words we're using to analyze and keep looking at the words and the concept that we're using and going, I'm still holding a position. I'm still actually creating a self. I'm creating an entity. When we use the word self, we're actually saying entity, thing that lasts. So even though the emotion isn't lasting the same way, it's really there. You see? Or the house is really there, even though my perception is changing. In fact, that's not actually how it exists. In fact, neurophysiologically, we have to create the house. The house doesn't just change. There never was a house there. That's neurophysiologic. There's no house. We have to create the house in our mind. And we have to keep refreshing the images in the house to keep the image going. So if you sit here long enough, I'll put this to the test. If all of you sit here long enough, like this, you will see that you're not actually seeing most of the room. You're only seeing about this much of the room. Some of you may have noticed that and not actually noted what you were meditating when your eyes were open, that you're actually seeing very little of the room. All the rest is constructed. When it deconstructs, some of you have reported to me very clearly, the room vanished. Now, not just that it got dark, but you experienced that the room completely vanished. You say to me, is that the experience of emptiness? Yes, it's a glimpse of emptiness. The nervous system can't hold on to many conceptual things for very long. It has to refresh them. And if you let the nervous system soften, it'll completely vanish for periods of time. Where you go. And you can't even recognize what it is. There's no recognition. Even though you're looking right at it, you can't have a name or a place or nothing for it. It might just be light or absolute darkness. The whole visual system can actually shut down, not by due to a stroke, just by relaxation, where the room is utterly dark. It takes a lot of energy to create this in our mind. All the time. So he's saying a permanent can't truly exist and an impermanent can't truly exist. As soon as you say it's impermanent, you're making the thing permanent. It's just changing. The tree is changing its leaves. Therefore, you're saying there's still a tree. No such thing. Perceiver creates the tree because the tree is a concept. I guarantee the tree doesn't have a concept of tree like we have it. An ant doesn't. We saw the most incredible thing this morning. Laurel and I saw the most incredible thing looking out the window of Tara Cabin. We saw a squirrel go up the flagpole, the prayer flagpole, and in its mouth was a giant wad of prayer flag. It had torn off a big piece of prayer flag. So cool. Wasn't that fun? We tried to photograph it and get a movie, but it kept looking back and going, nope, no way. And it came down, and it's chewing away on this and getting it. That's a big wad of prayer flag. And it was dancing around, right? It was really cool. It was dancing around, prancing. It was pretty cool. And then it went off. I doubt that the squirrel has the same concept of prayer flag. And I doubt that the squirrel actually sees the prayer flag and experiences the prayer flag the way we do, right? It might be having an idea of what marvelous nest material. Now, I don't think any of us have ever had the idea of using prayer flags as nesting material. Or couch liner, or stuffing, or a way of lining our rooms so that we have a more comfortable room. And, you know, filling it maybe with twigs and things, and we get this beautiful, lovely room coated with prayer flags. So we can have babies. I doubt it, but it's possible. So whenever you get fixated on how something looks, think this way. Human beings are extremely rare. Human beings may make up 0.00000000001% of the entire population, by not by number but by species, of all the creatures on this planet. Just think of it this way. We constantly think that the way the world is the way we see. Just try to reflect whether a mosquito, an ant, any of the at least 2 million different species of insects, or 5 million or 10, I can't remember what it's at right now, 10 million species of insects, actually would see the world the way we see. Birds, we know, don't see the world the way we see it. They see way into the ultraviolet, they see into the infrared, they see all kinds of color spectrum, they don't see the world the way we do. So just whenever you go, Dharma Center of Canada is like this, maybe during a board meeting, then say, well, would an ant see the Dharma Center this way? Would a giraffe see the Dharma Center this way? Do the birds see it? Would a chipmunk or a squirrel see the Dharma Center this way? We're holding a view of the universe that's extremely rare. Yeah? And for some cultures that are different cultures than us, it's totally preposterous. Utterly preposterous. So where is the suffering? Concepts. The concept that's held in the mind is where the suffering is. It has to fall. All concepts have to fall. All conceptual contrivances have to collapse. Not negatively, positively. So I'm going to give you another thing to contemplate. It's also one of the translations. Support and supported is often translated as container and contained. Are the walls of this room the container or the contained? Are we contained or are we the container? Is the edges of a lake the container or the contained? When does something when is something the container and when is something the contained? When is something the support? When is something supported? Is there such a thing? What would you say, all wise one? Go take a look at it. Go to the beaver pond, go to sit anywhere. This is a really good way to demolish this. Is my skin the container? Is the inside the contained? Does this make any sense? And yet we use it all the time. This cup, where's the container and where's the contained? We say conventionally, this is the container, that's the contained. I want you to really look at that for some time and see if any of that could actually be true. Would you say the space in the room, all the air, is not the container, is something separate than the cup? Number six, these are some of the most central meditations of all of Dharma, everywhere you go. If the so-called self does not exist, okay, watch the demolishment of views. So now we've taken the position the self does not exist. How can the so-called agent be permanent? Now he's demolishing the idea of a creator. If there were things, then one could investigate their attributes in the world. We can also put the word in there. If there were subjects, then one could investigate their attributes in the world. Now, what that means is if there were real subjects, we could have real permanent things, and we could actually list their definitive attributes existing in the world. Now, this word agent is actually a translation for the word creator. Again, it's to do with these extremists. So from another translation, if the so-called self does not exist, how, this is exactly the same translation, when there is no so-called self, how can the so-called creator, there we go, creator be permanent? So you can't have it both ways. If a creator is an entity, it's going to have a self, right? Because self means entity. How could it ever be permanent? So this is it. Number seven, since a permanent, let's put in the word creator there because that's implied. Since a permanent creator cannot function to cause in gradual or instantaneous terms, so both without and within, no such permanent entity exists. These are the stages of insight. These are the actual, you'll see these in classic insight texts. These are the instructions for Vipassana, for penetrative Vipassana. The gradual stages of Vipassana, of Mahamudra and so on, these are the kinds of questions that a teacher will ask you, if you need them. Not always quite this way. So here's the question from number seven. Can a permanent creator cause things to exist when they don't actually exist? If the permanent does not change, therefore it can't give rise to new events. That's actually what it means. That's one of the meanings from the Buddhist philosophical tradition, is if it's permanent, then it doesn't change, and therefore something that doesn't change cannot give rise to new events or entities. Therefore, by logic, it can't change. I don't know if everybody getting that? It's a beautiful position to understand. If something's permanent as an entity, it actually can't lead to change, which means it can't create. It doesn't work. So next time how do you apply this? Next time you have an emotion, you say, my emotion is making me happy. My emotion is making me sad. Listen to your words. Actually, write that. If you can write that down, that'd be great. My emotion is making me unhappy. My emotion is making me happy. My emotion is making me neutral. My emotion is making me. Have you ever had that experience? It's my emotions. Just listen, write that down. It's my emotions. Go take a good look at that. Go take a good look, just sit with that. Reflect on that. My emotions. What does that say? That an emotion is a real entity and it creates my being. Isn't that something? Isn't that cool? That the emotion is the actual driver of my being. My emotions drive me nuts. What do you say? Does that make any sense? Does it feel right though? Because you've heard it so many times? But is it right? It's nuts. It's crazy. My emotion, my anger is who I am. I've heard people say that. I've even heard a psychotherapist once say, very eminent one say, you can't really be human unless you're a rageful being. Really? Yeah. Humans must have rage to be real. Real stuff. Emotions are real. This is the real core of human being. So listen to the logical outcome. I am my emotions. My emotions drive me to who I am. They create me. That means that emotion is a creator being. It's true. Underneath all that, there is an emotion that is actually creating your being. Do you think that's true? Would you say that, wise beings? And yet we hear it repeated a million times in society. Yeah? Ever said that to yourself? Yeah. But is it true? Nope. So he says here, in gradual or instantaneous terms, doesn't matter. So both without and within, that is outside you, and inside you, no such permanent entity exists. No, no permanent creator is sitting there creating you. Where is it? Go look for it. This is the basis of all these contemplative traditions. Yeah. And often teachers will, without these kinds of words, they will direct a practitioner to go find these things. Of course, in the Insight tradition of Southeast Asia, developed mostly in the late 18th, 19th century, in the Insight tradition, using the Abhidhamma framework, this is exactly what they're getting at. They're going, so where is that self existing? Is it in your senses? Is it in your feelings? Is it in your body? Go look, carefully look. So how do you do this? You have to slow down so much that you can see clearly what you're looking at and not in a blur. So when we're in a blur, we can't see. When we slow down, we begin to see, is the sensation a self? I've known people who've clearly experienced microscopic sensations, but they will hold to a self. Does nothing to demolish a self. I've watched this year after year after year of beings who experience the sensations minutely, coming and going, mental states coming and going, and they still hold dearly to a self entity, like crazy. Why? Why? Still want something to cling to. I do know people who cling to anicca. They cling to transience. Everything's transient. Everything's transient. I'm transient. Except emotionally, when something happens, it doesn't help them at all. But it's all transient. They just keep repeating it like a mantra. See? And a little bit more. Number 8. If it, the creator, the self, the creator, the emotion, whatever it is culturally, right now we've got emotions as the most important thing in bodies right now. Bodies and emotion are the thing right now. If it, the creator, were potent, were efficacious, was the causal agent, why would it be dependent? For it would bring forth everything at once. That creator, which depends upon something else, or sorry, that something, which depends upon something else, is neither eternal nor potent. Sorry, that creator. Yeah, you need to put in after that, in the third line, that a creator which depends upon something else is neither eternal nor potent. So could you have a creator that doesn't depend on something else? Watch this one. Just watch this for yourself. This is just lovely. Try this. If I had a real self, and the self was permanent, what caused the self? What's causing the self to exist? If something can't truly exist, and we know that, without causes, then what's causing the self to exist? Right? And if that's the case, how potent or efficacious is the creator? So then the creator would have to be dependent on other causes and things. Otherwise, the creator would bring forth, would generate, like Adam and Eve. Over there? No, I'm just kidding. Adam and Eve, it would be the creation story. Everything would pop into existence at once. But it doesn't happen like that. Yeah? So that which depends upon something else, the creator depends upon something else, can't be eternal, nor can it be truly godlike, efficacious to cause everything to arise. So that's the logic there of number 8. I like this too here in this another translation. It is neither permanent nor does itself have causal power. So we've just demolished the idea that a creator, including a self, can be a permanent entity that creates everything. It can't be. It relies on other causes and conditions, therefore it can't be permanent and it can't bring about things in reality. Okay? How do you find this out? You have to look really closely for long periods of time with a stable mind and look at what's happening until it falls. Where are these stories coming from that we have? We don't need to know. That's the beautiful thing. If we want to trace it back, we're never going to finish. We don't, for liberation, we don't need to know where the stories came from. We don't need to know who gave us a story. We don't need to know it was mom or dad or school or internet. We simply don't need to know anything. We need to look at the story right between its eyes, its eyeballs. That's all. And then what do we have to do? You're going to see it here. We're going to have to look at the looker, because we're still going to be feeling that the looker is an entity that exists. Getting the feeling of that? I'm doing the observation. I'm doing the liberation. I'm getting me my liberation. I'm going for liberation. That's a preposterous thing. I'm going to become liberated. I'm going to make it happen. Kind of a young meditator. I like Mark Weber. I'm gonna go for liberation. I'm gonna go for arhatship. I'm doing it. You're gonna hit a brick wall so fast? Not funny. Wow. At 100 miles an hour. And by the way, you crumple much more rapidly than a Honda CRV going at probably 10 kilometers. Crumple. I'm going for liberation. I'm gonna do it. What are you gonna do? Better call in the Ghostbusters. Don't know if you've ever seen that movie. Okay. Better call in the Ghostbusters. Let's end with number 8. And we've gotten through a couple hundred years of Buddhist debates, monastic philosophy, and some of the most important key insight meditations ever given. And we're still going. Number 9. Fantastic. What a mind. Nargajuna, what a mind. Incredible. And extraordinary. So if you want to understand the Southeast Asian insight tradition and how it actually does the same thing, but doesn't go to the nature of phenomena, but tries to get at the solidity of self and the suffering around self, this is the there's an outline in here of how it's done stage by stage by stage by stage by stage. All right. Well, we made great progress today. Number 8. I think do we have a few seconds? Any questions? Yes. I'll tell you what, before the question, let's open some windows because it's getting broiling hot right here. Let's open some windows. It's we might pretty soon have what's called Baked Llama. Not Baked Alaska, Baked Llama. Yes, go ahead.
How we're able to perceive things as different if there's nothing substantial. actually real. I'm not sure if I'm phrasing that correctly, but how, like, if nothing is real, what is it that we're perceiving as different? If I see the wood, if I see the floor, how are we able to perceive that? What is it that we're perceiving?
So we have to really ask the question of what reality is. We haven't got there yet. It's okay. It's fine. So the conclusion you might come to is that in this universe of experience, would you say this maybe? Let's just make this as a possibility. There's an infinite number of displays of phenomena that you can have. Is that correct? Even a coffee pot behind you, or a coffee pot behind you, can be perceived in a million billion different ways by different mental states, by different beings, at different times. Correct? That's extraordinary? Pretty amazing, isn't it? So none of this actually has a truly existing way of being. It has to do with the interdependence of the minds of the beings, the physiology of the beings, time and place. Is it getting closer for you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Therefore, one can have an infinite display to an infinite conceptual mind. Think of an infinite number of conceptual minds that can perceive forms and appearances in an infinite number of ways. Does this give you some of the majesty of this? Isn't that fantastic? Isn't that absolutely amazing? This should just be joy. And yet it's highly confusing to a conceptual mind that would like to have it this way or that way. Is that making sense? So feel where you're coming from. What is real? And I want to know what's real and cling to real. Why? I'd like to know why you want to know what reality is. Why do you need to know what's real by perception? So I'm going to pose a question for you that you can contemplate. Can you have any real perception that is correct? You know how they say in Buddhism, you know you're supposed to have a clear perception? You're supposed to see things as they are? Can you? Is that a false statement? Can you ever see, hear, taste, touch anything at all how it is, or do you need to relax into it isn't? This incense stick, we call incense, can be experienced probably a million different ways with 150 or 200 different uses. Why do we have to have it right? Could you imagine living in infinite possibilities and yet able to make a really good cup of tea and tie your shoelaces and read a book and be able to discern blue and red correctly and hear music really well all at the same time? So, hold on to your hats, and more to come. But I'm going to ask the question again, if you want to write it down. Why do you want a reality so badly, a perceptual reality that you know to be true? Why do you want that so badly? I'm not putting anyone down, I'm not being mean, it's just why feel the clinging to have to know what a coffee pot actually is, or a floor actually is. Why? What's driving that? Is it possible to actually have a reality that's real? Maybe this has nothing to do with Dharma. Dharma has nothing to do with perception as real. It has to do with perception as illusory and liberative. The nature of nature of perception is utterly open. It's totally unconstrained, but it's constrained at a relative level by genetics, epigenetics, and conditioning. But it's totally open. None of this phenomena is in any way the way it appears to be. Not at all. Do we have a dining room or a temple? Let's see a show of hands. Dining room or temple? Dining room. Temple. Neither dining room nor temple. Both dining room and temple. Is this outside or inside? Is those who believe it's inside, show of hands. Those who believe it's outside, show of hands. Those who believe it's both inside and outside, show of hands. Those who believe it's neither inside nor outside, show of hands. What do you think now? Can you feel that? That feeling of utter unobstructiveness, utter openness, is where we're headed. But we can still use the word, we're inside the dining room, but it feels like a rainbow echo. It has no substantiality, and yet we can use it, and we can use it with feeling, we can use it with love, we can use it with care, but actually it has no reality whatsoever. It's illusory. And therefore, that's called wisdom and loving kindness, wisdom and compassion. Okay, if I could ask the local Umzi to make a great dedication and aspiration. Let's read it in, we'll have to pick up the pace a bit in Tibetan and then in English.
Yeah.
Remembering that so many key instructions of Dzogchen and Mahamudra are contained in that aspiration. So we're actually, in so many ways, making an aspiration dedication based on the highest realizations and declaring the highest contemplation realizations of Dzogchen and Mahamudra. Good to see you tonight. And Marion, if that handout, I believe I sent one on pranas, on the five pranas. Did I send one on the five pranas? Okay, I better do that. So tonight will be some further considerations on the hollow body, the inner yoga practices, which will be why our thoughts and feelings get all jumbled up and rambly, what the actual inner reason is and how we have to purify that. All right. Good. See you later. And also one last thing for right this second is we have a few more days of, I believe, at least one or two days of clear weather. If anybody would like to join me after class and go to the pagoda, and anybody would like to do a little angle grinder work today and some hand sanding, any volunteers, that would be great because I think most of the patching is done, and we're pretty close to getting all the sculpture work done before painting. But any volunteers to join me? One, two, three. Anybody for hand sanding? That'd be great. Okay, perfect. And I'll head up right now over at the pagoda, and we can get ourselves set up for that. Okay, that'd be terrific. Thank you.